This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This time of year, doctors encourage people to get the flu shot. Yet the CDC says flu vaccination rates hover around just 47% in the U.S. Is that rate due to concerns over the efficacy of the vaccine or distrust of vaccinations altogether? Today, where we live, we're discussing those questions by looking back to the turn of the 20th century, when polio affected tens of thousands of Americans. Just ahead, we'll learn how one vaccine led to the decline of the disease. And later, we'll talk with a woman who relies on herd immunity to stay healthy. Granby resident Kim Brown has a medical condition that doesn't allow immunizations to protect her from certain diseases. What's her message to the general public? We'll find out coming up. First, my next guest was awarded the 2006 Pulitzer Prize in History for his book that described polio and how it evoked terror in the United States. In the book, Polio, an American Story, Dr. David Oshinsky explains how the development of the polio vaccine helped nearly eradicate the disease. David Oshinsky is also director of medical humanities at NYU Langone Health and a professor of history at NYU. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
For those of us who didn't live through the polio epidemic, tell us about the disease. Can you briefly describe what it did to people?
Well, I am old enough to have lived in the years before there was a polio vaccine. So every summer, polio would come like the plague. The New York City newspapers where I lived would literally have box scores of the number of kids entering polio wards. And it would come around June, it would get higher in July, it would spike in August, and then start to go down after Labor Day. And during that time, tens of thousands of children would be paralyzed by this disease. I remember coming back to school every September, and you'd see kids in leg braces, children in wheelchairs, the occasional empty desk where the child had not made it through the summer but had died. The belief was that polio was transmitted through the water, so they would close all the swimming pools, the beaches around New York City. This was from the end of World War II until the 1950s when the vaccine came in. And we couldn't go out in crowds. We couldn't go to movie theaters. The belief was you basically stayed by yourself. Everything a kid wanted to do in that era, a kid could not do because of the fear of polio. I remember my mother used to give me a polio test on her own every week. You know, could I touch my toes? Could I put my chin to my chest? And if you had the slightest stomach ache or stiffness in your body, there was a real panic that you may be coming down with polio. And at that time, there was no cure. There was no prevention. Every child was at risk. It didn't matter if you were a hands-on parent, a hands-off parent. Your child was vulnerable. So it was an extremely frightening experience, and it just came like clockwork every summer.
David, you mentioned that the belief was it came through the water. So was this a virus that was transmitted through fecal material? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, polio is really transmitted by oral fecal contact. So it can be in the water, it can be in food, it can be two kids playing together and sharing an object or, you know, shaking hands or wrestling. It's a viral disease. It basically goes through the mouth into the gut. And in almost 99% of the cases, you will, as a child or whoever has it, you will just excrete the virus out and you'll be fine. But in a small number of children, the virus travels through the bloodstream into the central nervous system, and that's where the problem is caused. What the virus does is to destroy nerve cells in the spinal cord, which cause muscle wasting and paralysis.
How far back can we trace polio, and why did we see it reach epidemic proportions at the turn of the 20th century?
That is really one of the most interesting questions. Polio has been around for thousands of years, but always in endemic form. In other words, just scattered cases. Something happened in the West, in Western Europe, in the United States, in Canada, early in the 20th century. And what you begin to see for the first time is polio in epidemic form. In other words, 100 kids are getting it, then 1,000, then 10,000. And the belief is that polio is actually a disease of cleanliness, that the more antiseptic our society became, the less likely kids, particularly infants who had maternal antibodies, were to be exposed to the disease at an early age. And therefore, what you begin to see is not only the number of cases rising, but the age of the person who is coming down with polio. You know, it used to be called infantile paralysis. It was infants, it was two-year-olds, three-year-olds, five-year-olds. Suddenly, it's teenagers, adults. And of course, the most famous polio survivor of all was Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, who got it at the age of 39.
You mentioned that this was a disease that that was found in Western Europe, and then it managed to come over to the United States. In your book, Polio, An American Story, you talk about some of the sentiment against immigrants in New York City at the turn of the 20th century when people were getting sick. This was thought of a disease that they carried here.
It is. Polio didn't really begin. It starts on its own in the United States at the very time it's occurring in Western Europe. But, you know, we do have a history going back to the Irish with cholera, Jews with tuberculosis. In the case of polio, the belief really was that the Italians brought it around 1915, 1916, because one of the neighborhoods that had the first epidemics was called Pigtown. It was an Italian area in New York City. But the fact is that immigrants had absolutely nothing to do with it.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with me is Dr. David Oshinsky, again, author and historian. The book that he wrote, Polio, An American Story, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in History in 2006. Now, do you remember the fear of contracting polio when you were growing up? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. In studio with me is Joanne Griswold, who took care of polio patients as a young nurse. She's a 1954 graduate of UConn School of Nursing. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We heard David describe a little bit about what it was like at the time before the vaccine was developed, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But what do you remember about polio?
From my youngest, my mother was a registered nurse also. And then I remember, excuse me, her concern, however she was reasonable. She made sure that I did get swimming. There were shorelines where we could take advantage of that and feel that we were fairly polio-free. What I do remember is staying out of crowds, not going into a crowded restaurant or a crowded, say, a concert. And many of these were canceled. It depended on the area. If you were near a town or a city where there was an increase in the number of polio diagnoses, then I do recall that a lot of the activities, fairs, whatever would happen during the summer, would be canceled.
You mentioned that as a child, you were able to swim along the Connecticut shore, so you weren't reliant on swimming
right.
pools that were closed
right.
at the time.
Yes.
So when you look back, do you think that the fact that you did not contract polio, was that just by luck?
It could be a little luck. However, it was very important. This was one of the things my mother emphasized. Make sure you wash your hands. Keep your hands away from your eyes, mouth. And also get your rest so that your body is in as strong condition as possible. And eat, well, a lot of fruit, vegetables, the same things we hear today.
Later on, you mentioned your mother was a registered nurse.
Yes.
Later on, you would go to UConn, a school of nursing. So when you graduated, by then you were taking care of people with polio?
I took care of them as a student. There was an epidemic that was very prevalent in southern Connecticut in 1952. I had just started my fourth year in the five-year program. There were a number of adults and children. I happened to be going through my fourth month of pediatrics. So I was on, that was communicable diseases. We had a number of children with polio, but the one I remember particularly was a four-year-old I was told by the intern we were getting a transfer from a nearby hospital and that she would need a respirator. Well, that right there raises a concern, a four-year-old child going into a respirator. She was, I would say, probably four and a half. She was brought up the stairs. The intern carried her up the stairs, talking to her very softly. And by that time, I had the respirator all ready to go, thanks to the engineering department. He explained that this was like a tent, only her head would be outside.
Is this like the iron lung, the pictures of the iron lung?
That's the iron lung, yes. And we tried to talk to her as explaining what was happening in as age-appropriate manner as possible. She was very cooperative, and at that time, of course, was this due to her fear? Was she curious? I think she was just fearful. Her mother was expecting another baby. They had brought her in by ambulance. Her mother couldn't come in because she did have polio. And it was interesting, the emotional state. With a child, it is very important to maintain contact, physical contact. She welcomed us holding her hands, talking to her, reading to her.
Joanne, could you describe the iron lung for us? Because many of us are familiar with that picture, but not everybody that got polio needed that particular treatment. So what was going on where the polio impacted their breathing, and what did the iron lung do?
Okay. There were three different types of polio, and one was called the bulbar or the bulbar spinal. When a person was affected with the bulbar polio, it could affect the senses such as taste, sight, vision. I mentioned that. In her case, it was affecting her respiratory system. And that was the most that was really feared, because if you can't breathe, your life essentially ends. The iron lung was a tube, a large tube that would hold a human being. It did have a cot type mattress that we made up. It operated, the principle of it was to, it's a little different now, but at that time it operated on the principle of negative air pressure. When you removed the air from the tube, it caused an expansion of the chest cavity, which then would cause the lung to expand. And then there was air that was injected, essentially, best way I can explain it, into the lungs of the person.
David Oshinsky is with us by phone. David, for the children that and others that had to rely on the iron lung, was this something that was a lifelong treatment for them, or were they able to get better?
That's a good question, and it was really just described beautifully. One of the other problems that you were on your back with your head exposed, so you basically saw the world through mirrors. So you actually saw the world backwards. It was a very frightening and disorienting experience. Most people would be in the iron lung for a couple of weeks or even a couple of days, and then once their breathing stabilized, they could leave. There were people, I have a couple in my book, one man was in an iron lung for 25 years. One woman died relatively recently. She'd been in the iron lung for about 50 years during a power failure. So in other words, the iron lung really became your life-saving prison. The iron lung had been basically invented for gas workers who were overcome by gas, so it was supposed to be a very temporary measure. But as was just beautifully well described, if you had bulbar polio, it might be something that would be not, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, you were not any better, and you would have to stay in the iron lung either until you died, and this could be a process that took years. Most kids were in and out, I would say, within a matter of months, but there was a significant minority for whom the iron lung became a lifetime experience.
And a precarious situation if the electricity went out, Joanne, what would happen then?
We had a pump, and we would have to manually operate the iron lung. And that did happen. When people were in the iron lung, there was an attempt made to wean them from it. Some people, as Dr. Wyszynski has commented, would leave the iron lung and do well without it. There were others who could not breathe on their own most of the time. They would be weaned to a chest ventilator. It was like a convex plastic cone, half a cone, that would be placed over the chest, and it would be operated essentially the same as the premise was, the same as the iron lung. They did well with that. I had one patient who finally went home. Her husband had architecturally changed the house so that it would be appropriate for her with her children, the three kids. She was graduated from the iron lung in the hospital, but only during the day. I understand, because I read an article about her a number of years later in the newspaper, that she eventually was out of the iron lung during the day, but every night had to go back into it. But the ventilator allowed her to be up in the wheelchair, out in the garden with her children, and so forth.
This is where we live. Today we're talking about polio, and later on we're going to hear more about the development of the vaccine that helped eradicate this disease from the United States. Joanne, when you were treating these patients, again, this was a contagious disease. What were the fears that medical professionals had about getting it, and what did you do to protect yourself?
We were cautioned, of course, by instructors. Before we ever went to work on a unit, we were given a very thorough orientation. The most important thing is, again, hand washing. Now, when I was a student, it was felt, Yale felt, that the organism was ingested. So we did not wear masks nor gowns, disposable gowns. A few years later, when I worked at Mass General, they were still gowning up. There was an epidemic in 55 in northern New England, and I took care of patients at that time at that hospital. We had masks. The gowns were over an OR scrub gown. It was a totally different scene. But there were still concerns about the possibility you could inhale the organism. As far as protecting ourselves, I never felt when I was working that I was exposed to it any more than I would be walking out on the sidewalk or going into an office building, for example. In fact, that was the only time I had a concern. I had to go into a large building in the center of Boston. I was in an elevator with about 30 people.
Did you not breathe?
I felt like I asked myself, should I hold my breath? But I just felt you do what you can. You wash your hands. We wore rubber gloves in certain instances. Rubber gloves were not used as much then as they are now.
Before we head to break, Joanna, I wanted to ask you, when news of this vaccine came out, describe how you felt, how your colleagues felt.
Very happy. Oh, this was wonderful. In fact, I mentioned to Carmen that I had never seen such a happy group of medical students facing their final exams because they gave us the vaccine at the hospital. And it was like a party. We were thrilled, of course, for children. There were way too many children whose lives were affected, families who were affected.
Joanne Griswold, again, is a 1954 graduate of UConn School of Nursing. She helped treat patients with polio early on in her career and was registered nurse for 64 years,
yes. But
who now lives in Massachusetts. Joanne, thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Well, thank you again for inviting me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, we're talking about polio today. It's a disease that affected tens of thousands of Americans in the first half of the 20th century. Dr. David Oshinsky will stay with us as we continue our conversation. He's the author of Polio, an American Story. Now, through science and philanthropic efforts, polio has been eradicated in the U.S., but where does it persist around the globe? We're going to find out after the break, and you can join us too. The number 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we've been talking about polio. The epidemic peaked in 1952 in the U.S. when there were nearly 60,000 cases. 3,000 people died. But the development of a vaccine helped eradicate polio from the U.S. Dr. Jonas Salk from the University of Pittsburgh developed the polio vaccine more than 60 years ago. To tell us more, my guest today on the phone is Dr. David Oshinsky, author of Polio, an American Story, which won the Pulitzer Prize in History in 2006. David, can you tell us more about Jonas Salk and how his work led to these trials starting in 1954?
Sure. Jonas Salk was heavily subsidized by the March of Dimes. You have to realize this was an era in which there was no federal money going into medical research. There was no big pharma doing medical trials. So everything had to be done privately. And you had this remarkable organization begun by Franklin Roosevelt in which the entire country sort of took on polio as the national disease to be conquered, everyone just giving a dime or sort of recruiting other people to give coins. And they raised really tens of millions of dollars, and they used a lot of this money to look for a vaccine. They realized it was going to be hard to cure the disease, and indeed the disease has not been cured, but they could prevent the disease. And what they did was to begin looking for scientists who would basically follow a playbook and bring about a vaccine. And there were two. There was Jonas Salk, who had a killed virus vaccine at the University of Pittsburgh, and Albert Sabin, who was working on a live virus vaccine at the University of Cincinnati. Salk came out first. And what Salk did, I mean, those were different days. I mean, he tested on probably 100,000 monkeys. 100,000 monkeys and chimpanzees were sacrificed. Then he went to testing of children. And much of the testing was done in orphanages or what they called in those days homes for the feeble-minded. You basically just went in, you got the consent of the administrator who ran it, and you tested. And finally, they realized that they had to test on hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of children. And in what was the largest public health experiment in American history, almost 2 million children were lined up. Some were observed controls, but most were given three doses of the killed virus polio vaccine, and about half were given a look-alike placebo. And what they would do then was to just check and see, and this was an era before computers, if there was any difference between those who were given the real vaccine and those who were given the placebo. It took a full year to sort of figure this out. And then in one of the most remarkable press conferences in American history, word came down the polio vaccine was safe, it was potent, and it was effective. And they literally declared a national holiday when that word came down. I can remember it very well as a school child. Excuse me. And President Eisenhower invited Jonas Salk to the Rose Garden, where for the first time in anyone's memory, President Eisenhower broke down in tears as he thanked Jonas Salk for saving the children of America
and
the world.
And David, I think we have a clip of President Eisenhower actually speaking to, again, this University of Pittsburgh researcher Jonas Salk at that ceremony you mentioned. Here it is.
I should like to say to you But when I think of the countless thousands of American parents and grandparents who are hereafter to be spared the agonizing fears of the annual epidemic of poliomyelitis, when I think of all the agony that these people will be spared as they see loved ones suffering in bed, I must say to you, I have no words in which adequately to express the thanks of myself, all the people I know, and all 164 million Americans, to say nothing of all the other people in the world that will profit from your discovery.
Earlier, David, you mentioned that Franklin Roosevelt was probably one of the most famous cases of polio, and it was his awareness and efforts, along with an individual that you talk about in your book, that helped raise money for these vaccine research. If he hadn't had polio, do you think the country would have gotten to that step so quickly?
I love that kind of question. It's a counterfactual question. So you can basically give any answer you'd like. It's a terrific question. I think the answer is we probably would have gotten there because so many vaccines came after measles, chickenpox, MMR, and the like. But it certainly spurred the process along. Roosevelt really and his sidekick, Basil O'Connor, began the March of Dimes. And one of the things they did was they turned fundraising on its head. Until that time, if you wanted to have a foundation or a charity, you got a couple rich people, they gave a lot of money, and there it was. This was during the Great Depression. There wasn't all that much money around from rich people. So what they decided to do was to get the smallest possible donation from the most people. And in doing so, not only did they involve millions upon millions of people, but they got volunteers like my mom, like my mother, who went around basically soliciting money for the March of Dimes. I remember going with her carrying a mason jar that would just be filled up with dimes, and we'd come to a big center and pour it on a table. And with that March of Dimes money, the March of Dimes revolutionized philanthropy. If you look at Susan Komen or any of the charities and foundations today, that playbook comes right out of the March of Dimes, the use of poster children, celebrities, the way money is raised. And they also, the March of Dimes dramatically changed medical research in the United States. In other words, how you bring together the smartest minds, give them money, and let them basically work for a common goal.
This is where we live. Today, we're learning more about polio. Again, it affected tens of thousands of Americans. Children were paralyzed. There were deaths. And on the phone with us is my guest, Dr. David Oshinsky, author of Polio, An American Story. Do you remember, like David, what it was like when polio devastated communities? What did a family member have this disease? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Armanda is calling from Waterbury. Armanda, go ahead.
Hi. In 1955, I contracted polio. I was 7. And I was from New Haven, and luckily New Haven Hospital had the serum that they were experimenting with. And my mother and stepfather had to give permission for them to use it on me because I had this horrible headache. And I couldn't pick my head up off the couch. And in those days, the doctors used to come to your house, you know, and the doctor told them, because in our neighborhood, so many children were contracting polio, and a couple of them had died. And so I remember staying in the hospital and having needles all day long. And I met a man from New York years later, that was a supervisor of mine in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he was paralyzed on his right side, and he had had polio the same year. But because he did not live, you know, where Yale New Haven Hospital, and was able to take advantage of the new technologies, he became paralyzed, and I didn't. I stayed in the hospital for a week, and that was all. Thank God, the medications worked.
Well, Armanda, we're glad that you did get better after getting that vaccine. So you have no impact from that disease today?
Nothing.
Well, Armanda, thank you for your call. David, we were talking again about the vaccine development with Dr. Joseph Salk and how families, millions of children, either were able to participate in these trials. Why was it so effective? Was it because people saw how deadly this disease could be?
I just want to say first that Yale New Haven Hospital did some of the most important research in bringing that vaccine to conclusion. So you should be, they should be very proud, and the people of Connecticut as well. For someone like my mother, this was risk versus reward. It was all the parents. In other words, one of the problems with vaccines today is that they do their work so well that there is virtually no evidence of the disease that they are preventing. When I was a kid, polio was everywhere. So for my mother, the issue was, do we give the child an experimental vaccine, or do we take the chance that my child will come down with paralytic polio? And polio, as you know, is a very visual disease. You saw it everywhere. If you go into a coffee shop, you may not know who has a heart condition, but you knew who had polio. You saw the leg braces. You saw the crutches and the like. So for my parents and for the parents of America, this was a no-brainer. There was an epidemic every single year, and here was an experimental vaccine that might end that fear forever. And that is, parents were literally pushing their kids into line to be part of that gigantic study or to get the vaccine as soon as it was proved successful.
And we know that polio has been eradicated here in the United States. I wanted to bring into the conversation now Dr. Melissa Held, infectious disease specialist at Connecticut Children's Hospital. She is also associate professor of pediatric infectious disease at UConn School of Medicine. Dr. Held, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We heard David talk about how because polio, the effects of it were so apparent to people that they were rushing to get this vaccine. And now we live in a time where we don't see the impact of deadly diseases. How close is it that polio could be eradicated worldwide? Do we know?
We're very close, but we've remained very close for many years. So we have not had a case of polio in the United States since 1979. However, we have had sporadic cases of travelers from other countries coming to the U.S. with polio. I believe the last case was in 1993. So it is still out there. You know, I believe in 2017, there were 22 cases that were at least recorded worldwide. You know, there's certainly many countries where they don't have a great way of recording or documenting these types of diseases. So I don't know that that's an accurate number. It's probably higher. But at least in the U.S., we have not seen it. And so it's hard for parents, I think, to see how an impact of a vaccine today, you know, has on our children because they don't see the disease anymore.
Babies are very young. I think at 2 months they start getting these vaccinations. So remind us what type of vaccination these infants are receiving and how often do they get it?
Sure. So there are a lot of vaccines we have today. The typical vaccine schedule starts at around 2 months of age, and there are several vaccines that they can get. Most of the vaccines we give under a year of age are called inactivated or killed vaccines. So the piece of bacteria or virus is actually killed or completely inactivated. So it has no chance of reverting to what we call a wild type and causing actual disease. Mm-hmm. So 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and then in the 9 to 12 month range, there are several vaccines that are given. We have the we call DTaP, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. We have a rotavirus vaccine now, which helps prevent gastroenteritis in children. The polio vaccine, and we also have something called Prevnar. It's Prevnar 13, which is against pneumococcal diseases.
David, I wanted to go back to you. We heard Dr. Held mention that there haven't been any recent cases of this particular polio for some time, but where does it still persist in the world?
As best we know, there are just a couple of countries where wild poliovirus is still circulating, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. They're often in the tribal areas. They're often in areas where, in particular in Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Taliban is very, very powerful. The Taliban opposes vaccination in most cases, seeing it sort of as a Western plot. And as you and your audience may know, dozens and dozens of female vaccinators in Pakistan have been killed by the Taliban. So it's very dangerous to go out there. The number is probably 22 is used as the number of cases of polio today in those three countries. The number certainly is higher. The problem is getting it down to zero, and that is going to be a very, very tough sell. We've gotten the numbers down from hundreds of thousands in the 80s down to under 100 today. The reason you want to get the number down to zero is you want to stop the transmission of wild poliovirus. And as long as that wild poliovirus is circulating, we must keep inoculating and vaccinating our children, because polio is only a plane ride away. In other words, if we go below herd immunity, a number in the United States where not enough people are being vaccinated against polio, and wild poliovirus comes here, we can have an epidemic.
Dr. Held, quickly describe herd immunity.
Sure. So that's a great segue. So herd immunity is something that is talked about a lot when we talk about vaccines. It's basically the ability of a population to protect those who are not vaccinated against infectious diseases. And it's different for every disease. So typically you need somewhere in the 80s to 90% of a population to be vaccinated against a disease in order to protect others who are not. And really what herd immunity is meant for is to protect those who can't be vaccinated. So they're either too young, so are newborns, and those with medical conditions. So they're getting chemotherapy for cancer or they have an immune problem. Those are the patients who we really want to protect.
And coming up, we're going to hear from a Granby, Connecticut resident who does rely on herd immunity because of a medical condition. But I wanted to fit a quick call in. Edward is calling from Stores. Edward. Oh, I don't think Edward is there anymore. I guess I'll just end with David again, David Oshinsky, author of Polio, an American Story. When we think about how the only disease that's really out there that's been ever completely eradicated is smallpox, with your research and what you've learned in the work that you've done, do you think we'll see worldwide eradication of polio?
I am certain we will see it. I will say very briefly that in a way it was much easier to eradicate smallpox because the people who get smallpox show the symptoms immediately. So you can use containment and surveillance. With polio, people can be silent carriers. They can carry the virus without even knowing they get the disease. So they're everywhere, which means you basically have to vaccinate every child. We will do that. We did it in India. Nobody thought India could be completely polio-free this quickly, but it has been. Wild circulating poliovirus is gone in India. There have been no cases in India. If we can do it there, we can do it anywhere.
We'll have to leave it there. Dr. David Oshinsky, again, author of Polio, an American Story, won the Pulitzer Prize in History in 2006. David's also director of medical humanities at NYU Langone Health. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Dr. Melissa Held with Connecticut Children's Medical Center will stay with us as we broaden our discussion to other vaccines most Americans routinely receive today. Why is there mistrust of immunizations when science shows they're effective in preventing deadly diseases? We'll find out after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been learning about polio, a disease that reached epidemic proportions in America in the early 20th century. Historian David Oshinsky joined us earlier to explain the efforts behind eradicating the disease in the U.S. Those efforts led to a widespread national vaccination campaign that the public in the 1950s fully embraced. But there are Americans today who don't trust immunizations, and now some preventable diseases are making a comeback, like measles and whooping cough. Why is there mistrust? Should public health officials change how they talk about vaccinations to parents and caregivers? What made you decide to immunize your child? You can join our conversation. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I wanted to welcome into the conversation Kim Brown, who lives in Granby. And earlier we were hearing Dr. Held from Connecticut Children's Medical Center talk about herd immunity. Kim, this is something that you rely on?
Yeah, it's pretty heavily. I have a genetic primary immune deficiency, so if people don't vaccinate, I don't really have the opportunity to respond to vaccinations. I don't make the antibodies that most people do when they vaccinate.
So you have primary immune deficiency. So tell us what you have to do to stay healthy.
Every day after I get my toddlers to bed, I infuse 3 grams of immune globulin, basically what everybody else has circulating already, but I have to do it daily because of how sick I am.
When we talk about immunizations in this country, there is some mistrust of getting vaccines. How do you talk about this with people you know, with your family, because of your medical condition?
I'm actually pretty open about my illness because of that. I see the larger benefit of being kind of an open book with anyone who will talk to me. So when my family and I found out I had this, it wasn't until later in life, unfortunately, because of how rare it is. I told them, you know, that I try to break it down as basic as I can. I tell them that something is just missing from my immune system. So while it wants to function, there's just something missing. So in order for me to stay healthy, I rely on them to get their vaccinations. And we practice really good hand washing. You know, we make it a routine. It's just normal. You know, they wash their hands as soon as they get in from school. We do a lot of talking about antibodies. My 4-year-old could probably tell you what a T cell and a B cell is.
Oh, wait. So this is your family that you're talking with. But what about when you are public about the importance of vaccinating and you're talking to strangers, maybe on social media? What are the ways that they approach you when it comes to their beliefs on vaccinations? And how do you approach that mistrust that they might have?
For the past 2 years, my health got really out of control. I just haven't really seen a healthy point at this stage of my life. But so for me, it's like kind of life or death when people have this conversation with me. Recently, I had an interaction with a girl. She told me that if I just detoxed my body of vaccinations, I would feel so much better. And it really bothered me. So I tried to explain it. First, I talk about my illness because it's really rare. And then I go into talking about the importance of vaccinations. And a lot of people have brought it to my attention that it's, you know, it's poisonous. There's all these toxins and like, why would you put that in your child's body? But I see it as this is a preventative thing. There was a sign at a doctor's one day that said, if you could give your child a vaccination for cancer, would you? And I thought, heck yeah. Why would you want your child to suffer if you can stop them from that from happening? And it isn't just about me. It's more so the newborn babies, when they leave the hospital, they rely on us as adults to make the choice to vaccinate our kids. It's about elderly people on chemo, you know, like grandma and poppy. You know, you want to vaccinate so that you can have these long years with them. So I just try to, you know, show them the larger picture. And I try not to rant, but sometimes it really gets to me because, you know, I enjoy my life. I like my kids. I like being here with them, and I can't remain healthy, and I can't give them the life that I want to if others are not vaccinating. You know,
I wanted to turn back to our in-studio guest, Dr. Melissa Held, who's actually an infectious disease specialist at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. When Kim was talking, you were nodding your head. I'm curious. I had posed the question at the start of the segment about how should medical professionals be talking about vaccinations mm-hmm. with parents, because there is some skepticism, and I'm curious what you're hearing as a doctor and how you approach it.
It's a very difficult conversation. Many families come in, and these are educated families. These are often very highly educated families who've done a lot of research on their own on the internet, and you know, have come to certain conclusions about vaccines. This is not a 5-minute conversation, and really the primary care pediatricians and family doctors who are in our community are really our frontline providers in having these conversations. When I'm in the hospital, which is primarily where I am based, and we have families who are not vaccinated, a lot of times they'll say, oh, you know, can you come talk to this family? And usually I really just listen. I start just by listening to what their concerns are. Sometimes they're easy misconceptions that I can discuss with them. Many times it's that they're looking at fairly unreliable sources on the internet. And so I try to provide them with some information with that. But again, this is a conversation that has to happen over time, usually with their primary provider. And it is very difficult. I think many people say, why would you put something foreign in your child like that? And, you know, what I usually will say to that is the kinds of things we are exposed to on a daily basis are so far more than the tiny, tiny bits that are in these vaccines. And again, we know that these work. There are years and years of scientific studies to back up that these vaccines work. They work very effectively. But really, having these conversations over time and really trying to get at what their fears are, and having an ongoing conversation.
We touched on this earlier, but are vaccines in a way a victim of their own success because science has brought us to this point that people are not getting these deadly diseases, but they may be skeptical that they need to get this shot because they don't see it in front of them. When we talk about herd immunity, is that a conversation that doctors need to be explaining more to people in their office?
I think so, and I think Dr. Hachinsky had a great point that we don't – it's not in front of us anymore. Polio was a very visual disease. Measles is a very visual disease, and we are seeing more outbreaks of measles within pockets of populations in this country, typically in populations that are highly unvaccinated. So I think talking about herd immunity is very, very important, and having your guest now from Granby, I think that's a great way to have people understand how it affects people in their communities, our neighbors, our children's friends, because we don't see a lot of these diseases anymore, but they are out there. And again, that's, as Dr. Hachinsky said, it's just a plane ride away. These things can happen very, very quickly, and all it takes is someone coming from another country who is already infected.
There's lots of diseases out there and illnesses. The flu shot, I mentioned at the top of the show, only 47% of vaccination rate for the flu. That must be concerning to you.
It is. It is. I have a lot of conversations with friends on social media who don't want to vaccinate because they don't think it works, that it's not effective. Someone said, well, I got the flu anyway last year and I got the flu shot. So, you know, every year we get a flu shot because the virus changes every year. And the organizations that create the flu vaccine on a yearly basis have to basically anticipate and really look at the virus that's circulating around the globe to anticipate what might be circulating that next season. And so it's a challenge. And I know last year's vaccine was not particularly effective for adults, but actually at the end of the season, we were able to look back and say it was pretty good for kids.
So the message is get the flu shot, and if you were to get the flu, it's going to be less likely that it will be something that ends up in the hospital.
Absolutely. And, you know, even if you get the flu after getting the flu vaccine, you don't get the flu from the flu vaccine, but if you contract influenza, the hope is that if you've been vaccinated, you will prevent moderate to severe disease.
I want to thank Dr. Melissa Held, again, infectious disease specialist at CCMC. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, Kim Brown, who lives in Granby. Thank you for joining us today, Kim.
Absolutely. Thanks for giving me the platform.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Learn more about the show, WNPR.org/Where We Live.